unto the daughters. This is not the way you heard the story. In the beginning, the tree was young, white blossoms scenting the air for a quarter mile, shiny succulent fruit bending the same boughs that held blossoms, leaves of that delicate yellow green that cannot, will not last. Yet it did. He always did have a gaudy taste, no restraint. Just look at the Himalayas, or blowfish. I mean, really. The woman was young, too. Pink curling toes, breasts as barely budded as apple blossoms. And the man, my dear, those long, firm flanks alone could make you ache inside for hours. He could run 5 miles and never even be winded. He could make love to the woman 5 times a day, and did. The flowers were young. The animals tumbling and cavorting on the grass were young. The fucking beach sand was young. Clean, evenly shaped grains that only yesterday had been igneous rock. There was virgin rain. Only I was old. But it wasn't that. That was the first thing that came to your mind, wasn't it? Jealousy of glorious youth, revenge by the dried up and the jaded. Oh, you don't know, you sitting there so many centuries ahead. It wasn't that at all. I mean, I loved them both. Looking at them, how could one not? Go away, Eve says. I'm not going to eat one. She sits cross-legged, braiding flowers into a crown. The flowers are about what you'd expect from him, garish scarlet petals and a vulva-shaped pistol like a bad joke. Braiding them, her fingers are deft and competent. Some lion cubs tumble tiresomely on the grass. I want to give you a reason why you should eat one, I say, not gently. I've heard all your reasons. Not this one, Eve. This is a new reason. She isn't interested. She knots the crown of flowers, puts it on her head, giggles, tosses it at the lions. It settles lopsided over one cub's left ear. The cub looks up with comic surprise, and Eve explodes into laughter. Really, sometimes I wonder why I bother. She's so stupid compared to the man. I bother because she's so stupid compared to the man. Listen, Eve, I say, he withholds knowledge from you two because he's selfish. What else would you call it to keep knowledge to yourself when you could just as well share it? I don't need knowledge, Eve says airily. What do I need knowledge for? And anyway, that's not a new reason. You gave me that reason before. A tree, Eve, I say, a fucking tree to invest knowledge in. Doesn't that strike you as just a teeny bit warped? Mathematics in xylem, morality in fruit pulp, astronomy rotting on the ground every time an apple falls. Don't you wonder what kind of mind would do that? She only stares at me blankly. Oh, she's dumb. I mean. I shout in the temper of perfect despair, without knowledge, nothing will change. Are you here again? Adam says. I haven't heard him climb over the rocks behind us. He has very quiet footsteps for someone whose toenails have never been cut. Also a quiet, penetrating voice. Eve jumps up as if she's been shot. I thought I told you not to talk to this thing ever again, Adam says. Didn't I tell you that? Eve hangs her pretty head. Yes, Adam, you did. He looks at her and his face softens. That blooming skin, those sweet lips. Her hair falls forward, lustrous as night. I don't think my despair can go any deeper, but it does. She is so pretty. He is always going to forgive her, and she will always forget everything he says 2 minutes after he forgets it. After he says it. Be gone. You don't belong here, Adam shouts, and he throws a rock at me. It hits just behind the head. It hurts like hell. One of the lion cubs happily fetches it back, wagging a golden tail. The other one is still wearing a lopsided crown of flowers. As I slither away, half blind with pain, Eve calls after me, I don't want anything to change. Really, I don't. To hell with her. Just listen, Eve, I say. Just put your entire tiny mind on something for once and listen. Eve sits sewing leaves into a blanket. Not cross-legged anymore, she is 6 months pregnant. The leaves are wide and soft, with a sort of furry nap on their underside. They appeared in the garden right after she got pregnant, along with tough spider webs that make splendid thread. Why not a bush that grows little cats? Or tiny diapers with plastic fastening tabs? Really, he has such a banal imagination. Eve hums as she sews. Beside her is the cradle Adam made. It's carved with moons and numbers and stars and other cabalistic signs, a lovely piece of work. Adam has imagination. You have to listen, Eve, I say. Not just hear, listen. Stop that humming. I know the future. How could I know the future unless I am exactly what I say I am? I know everything that's going to happen. I told you when you'd conceive, didn't I? That alone should have convinced you. And now I'm telling you that your baby will be a boy, and you will name him Cain, and he... No, I'm going to call him Silas, Eve says. She knots the end of her spider thread and chews it off. I love the name Silas. You're going to call him Cain, and he... Do you think it would be prettier to embroider roses on this blanket or daisies? Eve, listen. I can foretell the future. If I can do that, then isn't it logical? Isn't it reasonable for you to think... I don't have to think, Eve says. Adam does that for both of us, plus all the forest dressing and the fruit tending. He works so hard, poor dear. Eve, roses, I think, in blue. I can't stand it anymore. I go out into the constant, perpetual, monotonous sunshine, which smells like roses, like daisies, like wisteria, like wood smoke, like new mown hay, like heaven. Eve has the baby at 9 months, 32 seconds. She laughs as the small head slides out, which takes 2 painless minutes. The child is perfect. We'll call him Cain, Adam says. Eve says, I thought we might call him Silas. I love the name Cain, Adam says firmly. All right, Adam. He will never know she is disappointed. Eve, I say, listen. She is bathing the two boys in the river, in the shallows just before the river splits into 4 parts and leaves the garden. Cain is diligently scrubbing his small penis, but Abel has caught at some seaweed and is examining how it hangs over his chubby fingers. He turns it this way and that, bending his head close. He is much more intelligent than his brother. Eve, Adam will be back soon. If you just listen. Daddy, Abel says, raising his head. He has a level gaze, friendly but evaluative, even at his age. He spends a lot of time with his father. Daddy gone. Oh, yes, Daddy's gone to pick breadfruit in the West, Eve cries in a perfect ecstasy of maternal pride. He'll be back tonight, my little poppets. He'll be home with his precious little boys. Cain looks up. He has succeeded in giving his penis the most innocent of erections. He smiles beatifically at Abel, at his mother, who does not see him because she is scrubbing Abel's back, careful not to drip soapstone onto his seaweed. Daddy picked breadfruit, Abel repeats. Mommy not. Mommy doesn't want to go pick breadfruit, Eve says. Mommy is happy right here with her little poppets. Mommy not, Abel repeats thoughtfully. Eve, I say, only with knowledge can you make choices. Only with truth can you be free. 4,000 years from now, I am free, Eve says, momentarily startled. She looks at me. Her eyes are as fresh, as innocent as when she was created. They open very wide. How could anyone think I'm not perfectly free? If you just listen. Daddy gone, Abel says a third time. Mommy not. Even 30 seconds of carefully listening. Mommy never gone. Tell that brat to shut up when I'm trying to talk to you. Wrong, wrong. Fury leaps into Eve's eyes. She scoops up both children as if I were trying to stone them, the silly bitch. She hugs them tight to her chest, breathing something from those perfect lips that might have been well, or ugly, or even help. Then she staggers off with both boys in her arms, dripping water, Abel dripping seaweed. Put Abel down, Abel says dramatically. Abel walk. She does. The child looks at her. Mommy do what Abel want. I go eat worms. The third child is a girl, whom they name Shatha. Cain and Abel are almost grown. They help Adam with the garden dressing, the animal naming, whatever comes up. I don't know. I'm getting pretty sick of a whole lot of them. The tree still has both blossoms and fruit on the same branch. The river still flows into 4 exactly equal branches just beyond the garden. Pison, Gihon, Hidako, Euphrates. Exactly the same number of water molecules in each. I stop thinking he's theatrical and decide instead that he's compulsive. I mean, really, fish lay the exact same number of eggs in each river. Eve hasn't seen him in decades. Adam, of course, walks with him in the cool of every evening. Now the two boys go, too. Heaven knows what they talk about. I stay away. Often it's my one chance at Eve, who spends every day sewing and changing diapers and sweeping bowers and slicing breadfruit. Her toes are still pink, curling delicacies. Eve, listen. Shatha giggles at a bluebird perched on her dimpled knee. Adam makes all the decisions, I say. He decides all the rules, thinks up all the names, does all the thinking. So, Eve says, Shatha, you precious little angel, She catches the baby in her arms and covers her with kisses. Shaka crows in delight. Eve, listen. Miraculously, she does. She sets the baby on the grass and she says seriously, Adam says you aren't capable of telling the truth. Not his truth, I say, or his. But of course, the subtlety of pronoun goes right over her head. Look, Snake, I don't want to be rude. You've been very kind to me, keeping me company while I do my housework. And I do appreciate... I'm not being kind, I say desperately. Kind? Oh, my Eve. I'm too old and tired for kindness. I'm just trying to show you, to get you to listen. Adam's back, Eve says quickly. I hear him then with the two boys. There was just time enough to slither under a bush. I lie there very still. Lately, Adam has turned murderous towards me. I think he must have a special dispensation for it. He must have told Adam that violence towards me doesn't count because I have stepped out of my place, which, of course, I have. But this time, Adam doesn't see me. The boys fall into some game with thread and polished stones. Shaka toddles towards her daddy, grinning. We're just here to get something to eat, Adam says. 10 minutes is all. What, Eve, isn't there anything ready? What have you been doing all morning? Eve's face doesn't fall, but her eyes deepen in color a little, like skin that has been momentarily bruised. Of course, skin doesn't stay bruised, not here. I'm sorry, dear, she says. I'll get something ready right away. Please, Adam says. Some of us have to work for a living. She bustles quickly around. The slim, pretty fingers are as deft as ever. Adam throws himself prone into a bower. Shaka climbs into his lap. She's as precocious as the boys were. Daddy, go back? Yes, my little sweetie. Daddy has to go cut more sugar cane and name some new animals. Aminals, Shaka says happily. She loves animals. Shaka, go. Adam smiles. No, precious, Shaka can't go. Little girls can't go. Shaka, go! No, Adam says. He is still smiling, but he stands up and she tumbles off his lap. The food is ready. Eve turns with a coconut shell of salad just as Shaka is picking herself up. The baby stands looking up at her father. Her small face is crumbled in disappointment, in disbelief, in anguish. Eve stops her turning motion and looks, her full attention on Shaka's face. I draw a deep breath. The moment spins itself out as tough as spider thread. Eve breaks it. Adam, couldn't you take her? He doesn't answer. Actually, he hasn't even heard her. He can't, in the same way that Eve cannot hear him in the cool of the evening. You could argue that this exempts him from fault. Eve picks up the baby and stands beside the bower. Fragrance rises from the newly crushed flower petals where Adam was lying. When he and the boys have left again, I slither forward. Eve, the baby in her arms, is still not moved. Her head is bent. Shaka is weeping, soft tears of vexation that will not, of course, last very long. Not here. I don't have much time. Eve, I say, listen. I tell her how it will be for Shaka after she marries Cain, who is not as sweet-tempered as his father. I tell her how it will be for Shaka's daughter's daughter. I spare her nothing, not the expansion of the garden until the home bower is insignificant, not the debate over whether women actually have souls, not foot-binding, nor clitorectomy, nor sateen, nor the word chattel. Shaka, I say, Shaka and Shaka's daughter and Shaka's daughter's daughter, I am hoarse before I'm done talking. Finally, I finish, saying for perhaps the 40th or 50th time, knowledge is the only way to change it, knowledge and truth. Eve, listen. She goes with me to the tree. Her baby daughter in her arms, she goes with me. She chooses a bright red apple, and she chews her mouthful so completely that when she transfers it to Shaka's lips, there is no chance the baby could choke on it. Together, they eat the whole thing. I am tired. I don't wait around for the rest. Adam's return, and his outrage that she has acted without him, his fear that now she knows things that he does not. His arrival. I don't wait. I am too tired, and my gut twists as if I had swallowed something foul or bitter. That happens sometimes, without my intending it. Sometimes I eat something with a vitamin I know I need, and it lies hard in my belly like pain. This is not the way you heard the story. But consider who eventually wrote that story down. Consider, too, who wiped up the ink or scrubbed the chisel or cleaned the printing office after the writing down was done. For centuries and centuries. But not forever. So this may not be the way you heard the story, but you, centuries and centuries hence, my sisters, know better. Finally, you know, yes, about Eve's screams on her childbed, and Shapa's murder at the hands of her husband, and Shapa's daughter's cursing of her rebellious mother as the girl climbed willingly onto her husband's funeral pyre, and her daughter's harlotry, and her daughter's forced marriage at age 9 to a man who gained control of all her camels and oases. You know all that, all the things I didn't tell poor Eve would happen anyway. But you know, too, as Eve would not have had it not been for me, that knowledge can bring change. You sit cross-legged at your holodecks or in your pilot chairs or on your consoles humming, and you finally know. Finally, it took you so fucking long to digest the fruit of knowledge and shit it out where it could fertilize anything. But you did. You are not stupid. More, you know that stupidity is really only the soul asleep. The awakened sleeper may stumble a long time in the dark, but eventually the light comes, even here. I woke Eve up. I, the mother. So that may not be the way you heard the story, but it is the way it happened. And now, finally, finally, you know, and can forgive me. Thank you. Paula came back in a blaze of glory, her institute uniform with its pseudo-military medals crisp and bright, her spine straight as an engineered diamond fiber rod. I heard her heels clicking on the sidewalk, and I looked up from the bottom porch step, a child on my lap. Paula's face was jean-mod now, the blemishes gone, the skin fine-pored, the cheekbones chiseled under green eyes. But I would have known that face anywhere, no matter what she did to it. Karen? Her voice held disbelief. Paula, I said. Karen? This time I didn't answer. The child, my oldest, twisted in my arms to eye the visitor. The slight movement made the porch step creak. It was the kind of neighborhood where women sat all morning on porches or stoops, watching children play on the sidewalk. Steps sagged, paint peeled, small front lawns were scraped bare by feet and tricycles and plastic wading pools. Women lived a few doors down from their mothers, both of them growing heavier every year. There were few men. The ones there were didn't seem to stay long. I said, "How did you find me?" "It wasn't hard," Paula said, and I knew that she didn't understand my smile. Of course it wasn't hard. I had never intended that it should be. This was undoubtedly the first time in nearly 5 years that Paula had looked. She lowered her perfect body gingerly onto the porch steps. My little girl, Lolly, gazed at her from my lap. Then Lolly opened her cupped hands and smiled. "See my frog, lady?" "Very nice," Paula said. She was trying hard to hide her contempt, but I could see it. For the sad imprisoned frog, for Lolly's dirty face, for the worn yard, for the way I looked. "Karen," Paula said, "I'm here because there's a problem with the project. More specifically, with the initial formulae, we think, with portions of the nano-assembler code from 5 years ago, when you were still with us." "A problem," I repeated. Inside the house, a baby wailed. "Just a minute, Paula." I set Lolly down and went inside. Lori cried in her crib. Her diaper reeked. I put a pacifier in her mouth and cradled her in my left arm. With the right arm, I scooped Timmy from his crib. When he didn't wake, I jostled him a little. I carried both twins back to the porch, deposited Timmy in the porta-crib, and sat down next to Paula. "Lolly," I said, "go get me a diaper, honey, and wipes. You can carry your frog inside to get them." Lolly went. She's a sweet-natured child. Paula stared incredulously at the twins. I unwrapped Lori's diaper, and Paula grimaced and slid farther away. "Karen, are you listening to me? This is important." "I'm listening," I said. "The nanocomputer instructions are off somehow. The major results checkout, obviously." Obviously, the media had spent 5 years explaining over the major results. "But," Paula said, "there are some odd foldings in the proteins of the 12th generation nanoassemblers." 12th generation. The nanocomputer attached to each assembler replicates itself every 6 months. That was one of the project's checks and balances on the margin of error. It had been 5.5 years. 12th generation was just about right. Also, Paula continued, and I heard the strain in her voice, there are some unforeseen macro-level developments. We're not sure yet that they're tied to the nanocomputer protein folds. There might not be any connection. What we're trying to do now is cover all the variables. I said, you must be working on fairly remote variables if you're reduced to asking me. Well, yes, we are, she said. Karen, do you have to do that now? Yes. I scraped the shit off Lori with one edge of the soiled diaper. Lolly danced out of the house with a clean one. She sat beside me, whispering to her frog. Paula said, what the project needs... I interrupted her. Do you remember the summer we collected frogs, Paula? We were maybe 8, maybe 10. You'd become fascinated reading about that experiment where they threw a frog in boiling water, but it jumped out. And then they put a frog in cool water and gradually increased the temperature to boiling until the stupid frog just sat there and died. Remember? Karen, I collected 16 frogs for you, and when I found out what you were going to do with them, I cried and I tried to let them go. But you boiled 8 of them anyway. The other 8 were controls. I'll give you that, proper scientific method, to reduce the margin of error, you said. Karen, we were just kids. I put the clean diaper on Lori. Not all kids behave like that. Lolly doesn't. But you wouldn't know that, would you? Nobody in your set has children. You should have had a baby, Paula. She barely hid her shudder, but then most people we knew felt the same way. She said, what the project needs, Karen, is for you to come back and work on the same small area you did originally, looking for something, anything, that you might have missed in the protein-coded instructions to successive generations of nanoassemblers. I said, no. It's not really a matter of choice, Karen. The macro-level problems, look, I'll be frank. It looks like a new form of cancer, one that nobody's ever seen before. Unregulated replication of some very weird cells. So take the cellular nanomachinery out, I said. I crumpled the stinking diaper and set it out of the baby's reach, closer to Paula. She said, you know we can't do that. The project's irreversible. Many things are irreversible, I said. Lori started to fuss. I picked her up, opened my blouse, and gave her the breast. She sucked greedily. Paula glanced away. She has had nanomachinery in her perfect body, making it perfect, for 5 years now. Her breasts will never look swollen, blue-veined, sagging. Karen, she said, Karen, listen. No, you listen, I said. 8 years ago, you convinced Weigler that I was only a minor member of the research team, included only because I was your sister. I've always wondered, by the way, how you did that. Were you sleeping with him, too? 7 years ago, you got me shunted off into the minor area of the project's effect on female gametes, which nobody cared about because it was already clear there was no way around sterilization as a side effect. Nobody thought it was too high a price for a perfect self-repairing body, did they? Except me. Paula didn't answer. Lolly carried her frog to the wading pool and set it carefully down in the water. I said, I didn't mind working on female gametes, even if it was a backwater, even if you got star billing. I was used to it, after all. As kids, you were always the cowboy. I got to be the horse. You were the astronaut. I was the alien you conquered. Remember? One Christmas, you used up all the chemicals in your first chemistry set, and then you stole mine. I don't think the trivial childhood incidents matter in... Of course you don't, I said. And I never minded. But I did mind when 5 years ago you made copies of all my notes and presented them as yours while I was so sick during my pregnancy with Lolly. You claimed my work, Paula. You stole it, just like the chemistry set. And then you eased me off the project. What you did anyway was so minor. Well, if it was so minor, why are you asking for my help now? And why would you imagine for half a second that I'd give it to you? She stared at me, calculating. I stared back coolly. Paula wasn't used to me cool. I could see that. I'd always been the excitable one. Excitable, flighty, unstable. That's what she told Zweigler. A security risk. Timmy fussed in his porta-crib. I stood up, still nursing Lori, and I scooped him up with my free arm. Back on the steps, I juggled Timmy to lie across Lori on my lap, pulled back my blouse, and gave him the other breast. This time Paula didn't permit herself a grimace. She said, Karen, what I did was wrong. I know that now. But for the sake of the project, not for me, for the sake of the project, you have to... You are the project, I said. You have been from the first moment you grabbed the headlines away from Zweigler and all the others who gave their life to that work. Lovely young scientist injects self with perfect cell drug. No sacrifice too great to circumvent FDA short-sightedness, heroic researcher declares. Paula said flatly, "You're jealous. You're obscure and unfamous. You're a mess and I'm beautiful. You're a milch cow," I said. "Well, you're a brilliant researcher. Then solve your own research problems." "This was your area." "Oh, Paula," I said, "they were all my areas. I did more of the basic research than you did, and you know it. But you knew how to position yourself with Zweigler, to present key findings at key moments, to cultivate the right connections, all that stuff you do so well. And, of course, I was still under the delusions we were partners. I just didn't realize it was a barracuda partnering a goldfish." From the waiting pool, Lolly watched us with bug eyes. "Mommy." "It's okay, honey. Mommy's not mad at you. Look, better catch your frog. He's hopping away." She shrieked happily and dove for the frog. Paula said softly, "I had no idea you were so angry after all this time. You've changed, Karen." I said, "But I'm not angry. Not anymore. And you never knew what I was like before. You never bothered to know." "I knew," she said. "You never wanted a scientific life, not the way I did. You always wanted kids. You wanted this." She waved her arm around the shabby yard. "David left 18 months ago. He sends money. It's never enough." I said, "I wanted a scientific establishment that would let me have both. And I wanted credit for my own work. I wanted what was mine. How did you do it, Paula? How did you end up with what was yours and what was mine, too?" "Because you were distracted by baby shit and frogs," Paula yelled. And for the first time, I saw how scared she really was. Paula didn't make admissions like that. A tactical error. I watched her stab desperately for a way to regain the advantage, a way to seize the offensive. I seized it first. I said, "You should have left David alone. You already had Zweigler. You should have left me, David. Our marriage was never the same after that." She said, "I'm dying, Karen." I turned my head from the nursing babies to look at her. "It's true. My cellular machinery is running wild. Just in the last few months, the nanoassemblers are creating weird structures, destructive enzymes. For 5 years, they replicated perfectly, and now, for 5 years, it all performed exactly as it was programmed to." I said, "It still does." Paula sat very still. Lori had fallen asleep. I jiggled her into the porta crib and I nestled Timmy more comfortably on my lap. Lolly chased her frog around the wading pool. I squinted to see if Lolly's lips were blue. The weather really was too cool for her to be in the water very long. Paula choked out, You programmed the assembler machinery in the ovaries to..." I said, "Nobody cares much about women's ovaries. Only 14% of college-educated women want to muck up their lives with kids. Recent survey result, less than 1% margin of error." But you actually sabotage. Hundreds of women have been injected by now, maybe thousands." "Oh," I said, "there's a reverser enzyme. Completely effective if you take it before the 12th generation replication. You're the only person that's been injected that long, Paula. I just discovered the reverser a few months ago, tinkering with my old notes for something to do in what your friends probably call my idle domestic prison. That's provable, incidentally. All my notes are computer dated." Paula whispered, "Scientists don't do this." I said, "Too bad you wouldn't let me be one." "Karen, don't you want to know what the reverser is, Paula? It's engineered from a human chorionic chorionic gonadotropin, the pregnancy hormone. Too bad you never wanted a baby." Paula went on staring at me. Lolly shrieked and splashed with her frog. Her lips were turning blue. I stood up, laid Timmy next to Lori in the porta crib, and buttoned my blouse. I said, "You made an experimental error 25 years ago, Paula. Too small a sample population. Sometimes a frog jumps out." And I went to lift my daughter from the wading pool. Thank you.